This is the Berkeley Signal.
Listen as the trees sing their songs in the wind. Lyrics and melodies for the spirit's senses, songs of laughter and life, timeless things in timeless places. Do not be afraid to be strong. Do not be afraid to love, but always remember. Always remember. Love wisely, the love of being, free of possession, the love of being beyond desire. The love of being, respect for Mother Earth. Listen as the trees sing their songs in the wind, lyrics and melodies for the spirit's senses. Songs of laughter and life, timeless things in timeless places. Do not be afraid. Remember, the medicine is in the time. Live this life to last. Join the time of tomorrow and the past. Be like us. Serve the creation. We will endure. Listen as the trees sing their songs. Listen. Listen.
We turn now to look at a UK-based movement taking extreme action to fight the climate crisis. It's called Extinction Rebellion. Its members have been super gluing themselves to government buildings, shutting down roads, taking to the streets to sound the alarm about the impending catastrophe of global warming. Extinction Rebellion marched here in Katowice last Saturday to protest UN climate talks. In November, Extinction Rebellion protesters shut down London bridges, blockaded the UK Department for Business and Energy, and attempted to interrupt Brexit negotiations.
They're very concerned about the state the Earth is in, the seriousness of things. You know, we're leading the world 3 degrees centigrade. Well, that's way outside the range that the human development has known. Enormous unknown dangers.
Tell the truth. Everybody needs to know what's coming. We need to know what's coming. Everybody needs to know. You need to wake up.
I only got arrested for the first time 2 days ago, and now I'm doing it again. To basically become disobedient towards the system as a result of our impending danger.
The government is criminally complacent in the mass murder of all life on this planet, and I will not be silent.
Those are members of Extinction Rebellion, a movement taking radical action to combat the climate crisis. It started in the United Kingdom just 6 months ago, is now spread to at least 35 countries. Extinction Rebellion is demanding governments commit to legally binding measures to slash consumption, reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. We're joined right now by Extinction Rebellion activist Liam Gary Balch. He just participated in the action here at the UN Climate Summit, not far from the Democracy Now! Set. It's great to have you with us, Liam. Even using words like global warming or climate change, people feel does not convey the urgency of this issue. You all have decided to use the term extinction. Extinction Rebellion is your group. Talk about what you're doing.
So we've been talking to people about the real science that we're seeing now, not in an alarmist way, but in a realistic way, we are now facing what could be the next mass extinction. We're already grieving over the lives lost, both human and otherwise, to climate change. And we're seeing and talking to people about the fact that we might now be facing human extinction. And so we're asking people to face that grief and feel that emotional response to this crisis, what we're calling an emergency crisis. We want to shift the language to that emergency crisis and to respond to that and move through that into action.
So explain your actions. It's just been 6 months since you guys got started. What have you done in the UK?
We just actually did our first action just a month and a half ago. We gathered outside of the UK Parliament and we declared a rebellion against the government. This is not a one-off protest or direct action against a specific corporation. This is an ongoing rebellion against our government in the UK over their inaction on climate change. So we lay down in the road and other people read out the declaration of rebellion, and then we said, we're here, we're going to keep rebelling, and I was arrested that day and taken away.
Yeah. And what happened?
And then we were released. Most of our activists have been released so far. They're aware that part of our movement is the fact that we have hundreds, if not thousands now, people willing to get arrested for this cause, willing to give up their freedom about this issue because the time for action is now. And we're calling on our government to tell the truth.
Super gluing yourselves? Explain what you did.
Yeah, so we shut down the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy a week later, and that led to a whole series of actions where people were risking arrest. We saw that activists decided to shut down this department for 6 hours by supergluing themselves to the doors. That's the department that's having backroom meetings with fracking companies while refusing to go and meet the people who have to live next door to where they're trying to frack in the UK.
You shut down 5 bridges. How?
So we've just seen an amazing response from that month and a half ago original action. Our campaign has just exploded. We now have a reach of 100,000 people. We're in over 35 countries around the world, and 6,000 people came out on the street on the 17th of November and blocked 5 bridges in central London. We had trained affinity groups in non-violent civil disobedience to take those bridges initially, and then members of the public in their thousands took to the streets and sat in the roads and celebrated our resistance against this system. People are angry and they're calling for a change to the system. I think that's what we've been seeing in the action going on behind us here. That's what we're seeing in movements like the Sunrise Movement and the school strikes. This is being reflected all across the world right now.
In fact, today is the school strike globally that Greta Thunberg has called for. And we're going to hear from Polish high school students who made it to the COP today, who walked out of school. How would you assess, this is your fourth UN climate summit. Do you think it has succeeded? Do you think it's failing?
I am aware that this system is broken. The political system in the UK is broken. The political system here at the COP is broken. We're asking for a citizens' assembly to be formed, a whole new system which can solve this crisis without the politicians kind of continuing to talk to each other. I'm here at COP to talk to activists on the ground, to learn from each other across grassroots movements around the world. And we're here to talk with those people about how they can join us next year on the 15th of April when we declare an international rebellion.
Human lives to prolong. Someone's playing God. deciding who should be alive and who should not. If someone plays with fire, but you know he's only building his own funeral pyre. Mind, I cannot see the sense of global suicide for the few who live in luxury. Perhaps it's up to you and I to save this world. We'll have to put up one hell of a good fight. A good fight. And we have a voice and bodies that are strong as the mountain. Yes, we have a choice. Part of the destruction or do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth. Do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth. Do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth. Do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth, do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth.
Bad news about the global climate every single day. We are burning more fossil fuels instead of less. The predictions are more dire than scientists thought, and the impacts are shattering. Now, a new book aims to convince us that art, creativity, and even irreverence are necessary to move forward on climate change, and that environmentalists perhaps need to shed their reputation of being killjoys. My guest is Nicole Seymour. She's an assistant professor of English at California State University at Fullerton. Her earlier book was called Strange Natures, Futurity, Empathy, and the Queer Ecological Imagination. She now joins me to discuss her new book called Bad Environmentalism, Irony and Irreverence in the Ecological Age. Welcome to the program, Nicole.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How do we know for sure that the more we fixate on the impacts of the crisis, the more of an opposite effect we have? I sort of think of, you know, if you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, if you don't stop smoking, you will die early. And that doom and gloom scenario is sort of a necessity for, you know, if I were a smoker, for me to stop smoking. And so we sort of expand that naturally to the environment, to the climate is warming. And if we don't do anything about it or do something about it, we will all die. But that doesn't seem to work to expand it from the personal to the humanity as a whole.
So there's a scholar I draw on my book named Kari Norgaard, who's found that, exactly as you're saying, that the more you know about climate change, actually the less likely you are to do something about that. And by that, she finds that people just become so emotionally paralyzed, so overwhelmed that, like you said, it has the opposite effect. And so I'm interested in looking at artists and activists who are trying to take this different tack to sort of even celebrate something like ignorance and celebrate something like irreverence. So maybe we don't need to understand all the details of climate change in order to act, right? So that suggesting that maybe everything we've always assumed was true about environmentalism, like that you have to understand, you know, scientific concepts in order to act, or that you have to do things perfectly in order to be an activist, they're really trying to throw those things out the window and saying, you know, what if we just did environmentalism in a different spirit, in a different mode or tone?
We have people at the highest levels of our governments telling us that there is no such thing as climate change. And so for a long time, climate activists felt that countering the denialism was absolutely critical because people trust their politicians, or some people trust some politicians.
Well, again, we're finding that that doesn't work, right? Yes. And sort of backing up for a moment, I think, is important and saying, well, why is it that people deny climate change? Is it because they truly don't understand? We've given them all these facts, right? We've tried to explain it to them, right? And they're still denying it. So maybe there's, for example, an emotional reason, or maybe they're towing a party line, right? If their political party says climate change isn't real, maybe they're just echoing that, right? And I think we have to understand that perhaps rational knowledge is actually informed a lot by emotion, right? Maybe people are understanding this issue through emotion and not through rational facts, right? And these artists and activists that I'm looking at are sort of following that line of thought, right? That maybe just shoving facts down people's throats is not working. So maybe we should try drag performance, right? Maybe we should try stand-up comedy, that there's other ways to go about it. And also what these activists and artists are doing is not just trying to, for example, you know, convince climate deniers or something. At times I'm finding that they're actually just acting out the absurdism and ironies that already exist, right? So the fact that we have overwhelming information that climate change is real and is happening, and yet some people deny it, that's an absurdist situation, right? That's a ridiculous situation. So oftentimes what these artists and activists are doing is just sort of drawing attention to the ironies and absurdities that exist in the world and just trying to express that, right? So that's sometimes their objective.
There's always been creativity in activism, no matter what kind of activism you're talking about. So I imagine environmental activists have a long tradition to be able to draw from historically, not just in the US, but around the world, of how to make activism funny, enjoyable, creative, and therefore effective, because no matter what issue you're talking about, it's generally kind of a downer. But so many issues are, by their nature, doom and gloom issues.
Right. I go as far back as the 1960s simply because I'm a contemporary scholar. And so I'm sure there's books that could be written about the role of, you know, humor in the original suffragist movement in the US. I think a lot of the activism and art that I'm talking about simply hasn't been recognized, or hasn't been recognized as environmentalist. And that's what I'm trying to say, is something like the Wild Boys TV show that was on MTV that I discussed, right? When you ask someone, oh, name an environmentalist TV show, it's probably like the very last thing they would mention. And so part of what I'm trying to do is to say, hey, this is doing environmental work. We just don't recognize that it is, because we assume that environmentalism has to be serious, has to be sanctimonious, you know, has to be depressing or sentimental or what have you. So part of my project here is to try to recuperate or recognize and sort of draw together these texts and show that there has been this pattern over the past 30, 40 years.
How does one find the funny in almost certain climate apocalypse? I mean, the news this year in particular, 2018, is so bad that I have a hard time finding a way to be humorous about it. Or is it that we have to employ humor and creativity if we really want to get out of this?
Where these artists and activists are finding humor is not in, you know, death or suffering or anything like that, but just sort of in this existential crisis that we find ourselves in, or in the inaction of the government, right? So it's, again, it's, you know, it's classic political humor, sort of poking fun at, again, the man, right? Poking fun at people who are preventing us from achieving our activist goals. But it is a very tricky, you know, you've got to be careful. And sometimes, you know, I talk about a couple jokes that don't land in the book, but I just appreciate what these figures are trying to do, right? Which is to find a new way to communicate information that just doesn't seem to be reaching certain groups of people.
There really is a resurgence of climate activism. There's a new era of it. Whether people are seeing that cultural shift, rather than, you know, publishing a new book about details of the latest science on climate, that engaging in creative activism is the way to go. Are they purposefully using some of the things that you write about in your book as tools?
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about a group called Queers for the Climate that have been participating in the People's Climate March, and they're trying to draw connections between LGBTQ issues and experiences and environmental issues, right? To show that LGBTQ folks have a particular investment in environmental activism. But again, they're being playful, right? They're dressing in drag. They're dressing in, you know, crazy glittery costumes and dancing around at the People's Climate March. So doing that work, but doing it in a different spirit. Another thing that jumps to mind that I ran out of time to talk about in the book, you know, you always discover new things as soon as the proofs are to the printer.
Right.
There's something called the Fossil of the Day Awards that have been given out at the last couple UN climate summits, the COP. Every meeting for the past few years, they've presented a Fossil of the Day Award to the worst country in terms of upholding their climate commitments. And they have their logo kind of looks like the Jurassic Park logo. And they have a little song, a little chant, Fossil of the Day, Fossil of the Day, who is the worst? Who is the worst? Or something like that. And they have a person dressed up like a dinosaur that's dancing around and hands out the award. So I think it's COP24, Germany has received one. And of course, the United States. United States always seems to get a Fossil of the Day award. So I think those are examples of how climate activism has inspired maybe sort of unexpected demographics of people, such as LGBTQ folks, to connect their struggles together with climate struggles. And we're seeing just all sorts of creative, innovative, unexpected performances and images and so forth. And so I find that very exciting and invigorating.
Humor is also often a great tool to equalize power differences between those in power and those who don't have power. I'm thinking of the, you know, the court jester kind of attitude. Is it important for us to laugh at our politicians, the ones who, in the face of so much evidence, still continue to spout absolute nonsense?
The TV shows and films and poems I look at are directing their ire at politicians in a funny way. But one thing I think is actually really interesting is that almost every single thing I look at in the book, the performers or whoever it is poking fun at themselves. And I find that to be very important. You know, humor can be very sanctimonious, right? We can be very smug when we're making fun of someone that we think is worse than us. And, you know, humor can be very self-satisfied. So I think it's important that these figures are poking fun at themselves to prevent that kind of sanctimony, right? So to prevent their humor from being only outwardly directed and not inwardly directed. So the well boys make fun of themselves and how inept they are and how stupid they are, for example. And you see that in the other texts I look at. Yeah, the humor goes in multiple different directions depending on the case.
Yes, unfortunately, environmental activists and other people too have a poor reputation of being self-righteous and having this attitude of they're the only ones who see how bad it is because they're the only ones who seem to be taking it so seriously. Therefore, it might be their job to draw attention to everything. And, you know, we also have environmental activists, unfortunately, whether it's deserved or not, have a reputation for being a little bit not all there. The tree huggers, vegans who eschew leather or honey. So there's fodder there to certainly make fun of oneself and maybe even embrace the weird, right?
We were talking earlier about humor and playfulness being important in lots of different movements, but I think environmentalism in particular, as you're saying, has this specific reputation, I think probably along with feminism, a particular reputation for being killjoy, for not being self-reflexive, for being like no fun at a party, right? So I think it's important, especially at this moment of crisis, that environmentalists are starting to take a look at themselves, right, and laughing at themselves as well as at the problematic politicians.
Are there certain tips that you can give for those people who might be watching? There's a lot of young people, as I mentioned, who are part of this, you know, new and growing wave of environmental activism. And of course, there is always a place for sort of serious activism, for even creativity that might be serious. But any tips for how to make one's activism irreverent and how to, you know, engage in that kind of dialogue that often does result from approaching something in a kind of an absurdist way?
Well, lots of things to say. I'm glad that you brought up the notion of young people, because I think that for someone who's not quite so young anymore, I think that's been the most exciting, hopeful moment to come out of recent times. You know, I'm thinking of the Parkland kids and just seeing youth really being reinvigorated, of course, for horrible reasons, right? Reinvigorated by the failures of adults and politicians to act. So I think, you know, the kids are all right. The kids are already doing it. They're already being creative and using new platforms to speak truth to power. I don't know if I have any tips per se, because I'm not a creative person. It's so fun to watch all these texts and, you know, I was laughing at them and then to be able to enjoy them and also analyze them. But, you know, I leave some of that creativity up to the more creative people, I guess.
So. I'm also thinking of the Yes Men and how the Yes Men have for years also pulled a fast one on sort of corporate figures and politicians, where they've literally pulled pranks that have been very successful pranks and ended up on national television, sometimes international television, putting words in the mouth of corporate actors, and climate is a big issue for them.
So that was another group that, unfortunately, you know, I had the DVD and I was just like, oh, I could have written this book for five more years. There's just so many, you know, there was Portlandia episodes I wanted to talk about, South Park episodes. So yeah, the Yes Men were one of those groups that didn't make the cut, not because they weren't, you know, doing the kind of work I'm talking about, but just at some point I just had so many examples I had to stop. But absolutely, you can see how far that irreverence can get you. What I appreciate about them is how they have this sort of deadpan affect. It's like a mock seriousness, right? And through that mock seriousness, you recognize how ridiculous the system is, how ridiculous political inaction is, and so forth. So yeah, I think they're a great example, and they would be great role models for young people coming up these days.
Do you feel that you might have also written this book to help stave off some of your own feelings of angst about the environment? I mean, it's really hard to remain optimistic at this moment in time.
No, it was definitely therapeutic. Just, again, being able to laugh. When you work on environmental studies, you don't often get chances to laugh. And yeah. I think I was just very hungry for finding these examples. So I think that helped a lot. And, you know, some days you just feel like, well, we're going to hell in a handbasket, but we're still going to fight the good fight. And there's actually irony in that as well, right? Keeping on despite not very positive signs about the effectiveness of our activism. There's something very ironic and maybe absurdist in that. But I think that's just the mode I have to exist in. That's the mode a lot of people exist in is, you know, we don't know if this is going to help, but we're going to try and see where it goes. It's the only thing we can do.
Right. In fact, in the absence of enough political action, I'm so glad you brought up, in a way, it is one of the only things we can do, this coping mechanism. If we're going down, you know, we'll go down with a fight and we'll go down with a smile on our face rather than gloomily. It's tough when wildfires are burning up and down, you know, our state here in California, and you had, you know, 85 people losing their lives and countless numbers of people losing their livelihoods and their homes. It's not an easy thing to feel lighthearted about, but in the end, it is also a very human thing to do, isn't it?
And there's a spectrum as well. You know, what I say in this book is that I don't think quote unquote bad environmentalism is the only answer, right? Maybe it's the answer for some people. Maybe it's the answer for people like me. I do think there are those moments where you just don't laugh, right? There's those moments where you can't find a single funny or a single hopeful thread to find in a news story. But I just think that this is one of the things we can do. So we might as well explore it.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old and I'm from Sweden. I speak on behalf of Climate Justice Now. Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. But to do that, we have to speak clearly, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. You only speak of a green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet. Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity of a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the sufferings of the many which pay for the luxuries of the few. The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within this system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past and you will ignore us again. You have run out of excuses and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland, where world leaders are gathered to negotiate climate solutions that could dictate policy for years to come. But we begin today's program with a climate activist who says politicians here are not doing enough to turn back the clock and prevent catastrophic climate change. 15-year-old Greta Thunberg. She's made international headlines since launching a school strike against climate change in her home country of Sweden earlier this year. She sat on the steps of the parliament in Stockholm every school day for 3 weeks leading up to the Swedish election in September to demand that politicians take more radical action to stop global warming. After the election, she went back to school, but only for 4 days a week, because every Friday, Greta continues to sit outside the parliament building. Her actions have inspired thousands of students across the globe to do the same. Greta has Asperger's syndrome. She's focused with laser intensity on climate change since she was 9 years old. She brought her message directly to world leaders here in Katowice at the UN Climate Summit. Here she is addressing UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres last week.
For 25 years, countless of people have stood in front of the United Nations climate conferences, asking our nation's leaders to stop the emissions. But clearly, this has not worked since the emissions just continue to rise. So I will not ask them anything. Instead, I will ask the people around the world to realize that our political leaders have failed us. Because we are facing an existential threat, and there is no time to continue down this road of madness. Rich countries like Sweden need to start reducing emissions by at least 15% every year to stay below a 2-degree warming target. You would think the media and every one of our leaders would be talking about nothing else, but they never even mention it. Nor does hardly anyone ever mention that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, with up to 200 species going extinct every single day. Furthermore, does no one ever speak about the aspect of equity, clearly stated in the Paris Agreement, which is absolutely necessary to make it work on a global scale. That means that rich countries, like mine, need to get down to zero emissions within 6 to 12 years with today's emission speed. Because how can we expect countries like India, Colombia or Nigeria to care about the climate crisis if we, who already have everything, don't care even a second about our actual commitments to the Paris Agreement? So when school started in August this year, I sat myself down on the ground outside the Swedish Parliament. I school striked for the climate. Some people say that I should be in school instead. Some people say that I should study to become a climate scientist so that I can solve the climate crisis. But the climate crisis has already been solved. We already have all the facts and solutions. And why should I be studying for a future that soon may be no more, when no one is doing anything to save that future? And what is the point of learning facts when the most important facts clearly means nothing to our society? Today we use 100 million barrels of oil every single day. There are no politics to change that. There are no rules to keep that oil in the ground. So we can no longer save the world by playing by the rules, because the rules have to be changed. So we have not come here to beg the world leaders to care for our future. They have ignored us in the past and they will ignore us again. We have come here to let them know that change is coming, whether they like it or not. The people will rise to the challenge. And since our leaders are behaving like children, we will have to take the responsibility they should have taken long ago. Thank you.
That was Greta Thunberg addressing the United Nations here in Katowice, Poland. renowned climate activist Kevin Anderson tweeted, "On climate change, Greta Thunberg demonstrates more clarity and leadership in one speech than a quarter of a century of the combined contributions of so-called world leaders. Willful ignorance and lies have overseen a 65% rise in carbon dioxide since 1990. Time to hand over the baton," he tweeted. We'll have Kevin Anderson on later in the broadcast, but we're now joined by Greta Thunberg. She has been named one of Time Magazine's most influential teens of 2018. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Greta. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
So you sat outside the Swedish parliament in September every day when all the other kids were in school. What made you decide to go to the Swedish parliament?
Well, it started with a couple of youth in the United States refused to go to school because of the school shootings. And then someone I knew said, what if children did that for the climate? And then I thought...
Oh, you're talking about the Parkland students in Parkland, yeah. Florida, after the massacre there, Valentine's Day.
And then I thought that that was a good idea, that maybe it would make a difference. And then I tried to bring people with me, but no one was really interested, so I had to do it alone. The second day, people started joining me.
Why climate change? Why is that so important to you?
Because what we do now, future generations can't undo in the future. We are deciding right now how we want our future to look like.
And when did you decide climate change was the issue you wanted to devote your life to?
I have read a lot about it, and one thing that I found very scary is tipping points. That once we reach tipping points, then there's no going back. Then we start a chain reaction beyond our control, and that is very scary. And so that I thought instead of worrying about how a future might turn out, you should try to change it while you still can. So that's what I wanted to do.
So how have you changed your life once you started to learn about climate change?
I personally have stopped flying. I have stopped eating meat and dairy.
So let's take these one at a time. You stopped flying. So how did you get here to Poland? You live in Sweden.
Yeah, we went here by electrical car.
How long did it take you to drive here?
2 days, including one night at a hotel.
Mm-hmm. And why did you stop eating meat?
Both of ethical reasons and by ecological reasons.
And what else have you done?
I have a shop stop. It means that you don't buy things, new things, unless it's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Talk about what you're wearing, your sweatshirt today.
This is a shirt from Hundar Utan Hem, Dogs Without Home, a Swedish organization which give homeless dogs home.
Do you have dogs?
Yes, I have two dogs. One is from there.
One is from that shelter?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how do you feel being here at the UN Climate Summit? How long have you studied the issue?
We arrived here last Saturday, and I started reading about the climate crisis when I was maybe 9 years old. In school, my teachers, they told me about it, and I thought that it was very strange that humans, who are an animal species among others, could be capable of changing the Earth's climate. Because if that was the case, and if it was really happening, we wouldn't be talking about anything else. That would be our first priority, but no one ever even mentions it. So I started reading about it, and the more I read about it, the more I understood it. And once you fully understand what it means, you can never go back.
So it's interesting you are sitting in front of the Swedish parliament every day for 3 weeks, considering most people think of Sweden as one of the most progressive when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, we have a reputation of being very, very green. But Sweden is one of the top 10 countries in the world with the highest ecological footprints per capita. And we have very high emissions per capita. And so we are not a role model.
The emissions have actually gone up in the last year?
Yeah, we have just moved them overseas. Our actual emissions in the country may have reduced, but we have just moved our emissions overseas. We let other countries produce the stuff we consume.
Greta, how do you explain climate change to other kids?
It depends on how old they are. We need to change now because we are not living within the planetary boundaries. We are risking future generations' future by continuing like this. We need to change ourselves now because tomorrow it might be too late.
What did the Swedish parliamentarians say as they would pass you each day, going up the stairs and down the stairs?
Most of them ignored me, and then some of them came up to me and said that you're doing a good job, but very few.
You started getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Did people bring you food?
Some. Oh,
did some that people. Change what you ate?
No.
Svante Thunberg is also joining us right now. Svante, how has your daughter changed you?
Oh, in every possible way, I'd say. It started maybe 4 years ago. She got herself in a position where she was learning a lot about the climate change, and she was finding out that everyone was saying one thing and doing the exact other thing, and that she could not cope with. So she fell into a depression. She stopped eating, stopped talking, and she fell out of school and stayed at home for almost a year. My wife and I we stayed at home with her, of course, and we did everything. I stopped working completely and we spent, all our time with her.
You're a well-known actor. Your wife is a well-known opera singer, and yeah. You both gave up your professions.
Yes, my wife is much more well-known than I am. I gave up my career when she was born, actually, because my wife was working overseas. So I basically, I went to become a housewife instead. But I do act sometimes.
And you have two daughters.
Yes, we have two daughters. Beata as well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Greta, can you talk about that time? It sounds extremely painful, a few years ago when you stopped talking and stopped eating.
I became very depressed. I fell into depression, and I was so depressed I didn't see any point of living because everything was just so wrong. And I kind of saw, because I have Asperger's syndrome, so I work a bit different. I see things black and white, and so I guess I saw the world from a different perspective, so I saw what was wrong with the world. And I,
what does it mean to have Asperger's syndrome?
My brain works a bit different. I usually don't enjoy participating in the social game that the rest of you seem so fond of, and I don't like lying, and I see things black or white.
And you focus with laser intensity on an issue.
Yeah.
Your issue, climate change. And Svante, what did this mean for you? How have you raised your daughters to deal with the world and in this crisis when Greta stopped eating and was almost hospitalized?
Yeah, she made us realize that we were these parents, standing up for human rights and refugees and right and wrong and all these things. And we were really fighting for that. And then she said, whose human rights are you standing up for? When my wife, for instance, went to Japan to make concerts and being on Japanese TV, very important. It's a good reason to travel across the world to do that. But when she got home, Greta worked out how many tons of carbon dioxide she had spent on that and how many people's carbon budget that was living in West Africa, for instance. So she basically, confronted us with that. Whose human rights are you standing up for? When you are draining the world's, resources, a functioning atmosphere, for instance, and so we basically realized in the end, after a couple of years of her going on about it, that we had to change, we had to stop doing these things. And that really had an enormous effect because she made her much more happy. And she changed a lot with that. So, yeah.
What made you decide to start eating again and start talking, Greta?
I thought that I could do so much with my life, and what is the point of feeling like this when I could actually do something good? And so, yeah.
Is your sister older or younger than you?
She's 3 years younger than me.
Mm-hmm. And how has she been affected by your choices?
I mean, she has also stopped flying and so on, and she also cares about the climate and the environment.
And how has it changed the way you parent, Svante?
Well, it changed. My wife she gave up her international opera career, and she's working out of Sweden now instead, and that was a big change for us. And obviously it's changed a great many other sort of things. I had to go vegan. First of all, vegetarian, then I had to go vegan, and I do miss the cheese, I have to, I must confess.
So what did it mean to you to give up meat and then...
Nothing.
And then cheese and dairy?
Nothing. It meant nothing. I mean, in the end, you know, we're facing a diet catastrophe.
We asked Greta in the first segment, mm-hmm. why she became a vegetarian. And
yep.
Are you a vegan also, Greta?
Yeah.
So, Svante, what does that mean to you? Why not have a meat-based diet?
Well, because of the climate crisis. I mean, obviously, we are running out of a budget, okay? I mean, the budget is disappearing before our eyes, and we only have a couple of years, less than a couple of years, to bend the curve, you know, steep down like a roller coaster. And I didn't have a clue about the climate crisis before she got us all interested in this. But once you start, you know, walking down that path, there's no going back. I mean, your life is changed in every possible way once you realize, you know, the situation that we're actually in. But I was so amazed that I wasn't aware of it, you know, because I was, you know, very aware. I was reading all the papers and stuff, and I just didn't realize where we were at.
What did it mean to you that your parents became vegan? Is your mother also a vegan? Greta?
Yeah, she tries.
You're teaching her. So what did that mean to you, how you changed your parents?
I mean, that meant that they were actually listening to what I was saying. And, I mean, that was good to feel that someone is listening.
You know, Svante, you talked about basically climate equity, about how when you consume a lot, when the Western countries like Sweden are engaged in fossil fuel pollution, what that means for the developing world. Greta, I'd like to ask you that question, this whole issue of climate equity.
Yeah, I mean, since we have a higher emissions per capita, we must reduce emissions more. And since we already have all the infrastructure and everything that we need to reduce our emissions much more so that the developing countries can have a chance to build some of that infrastructure and so that the people there can have a chance to heighten their standard of living.
Can you talk about your relatives? You are both the descendants of Svante Arrhenius, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who first calculated the greenhouse effect caused by carbon dioxide emissions in 1896, known to some as the father of climate change science. Svante, you were named after him?
Yes, I was. My family would name me after him, or my father did, because he thought, you know, that was very important. But the fact is, they didn't have a clue why he got the Nobel Prize. They, you know, he was just a Nobel Prize winner. Yeah, it's pretty nice, you know, nice title. My father's born in 1925, he's pretty old, and his grandmother's cousin, I think, is Svante Arrhenius. So, yeah, it runs in the family. I didn't realize until I started reading up on the subject, but yeah, that's our relative, yeah.
We're in this building here in Katowice, the main conference center of this city, that is actually shaped like a coal mine. Katowice, the heart of coal country in Poland. The coal company is clearly very prominent here. Your thoughts on that and what coal means for the world?
I mean, it's just crazy that we are here on the climate change conference, and I think it's sponsored by a coal company. But we need to stop burning coal, as simple as that.
You are protesting every Friday outside the Swedish Parliament now, from every weekday to just Fridays. Why Fridays?
Why not? Fridays are good days. Friday's a good day to strike.
You call it a school strike. You've also been following and tweeting about other school strikes around the world.
Yeah.
How many have there been?
Oh, I don't know. Many. Tens of thousands of kids in Australia. Also strikes in Belgium, Canada, the U.S., the U.K., Finland, Denmark, Sweden, France, the Netherlands. I probably forgot something now, but yeah, it's a lot of places.
Greta, explain again how you made it to Poland, how you got here from Sweden.
Yeah, me and my dad drove here in an electrical car.
Do you use an electric car all over Sweden, or do you use other forms of transportation?
sometimes that and sometimes train, bus, subway.
Mm-hmm. I also understand you do a lot of bike riding.
Yeah.
When you sat down, Geeta, in September, in front of the parliament, was there a discussion in the media? I mean, Sweden considered a very green country, about climate change?
Yes, it was, and it still is. I mean, all of Sweden say, oh, we're the best in the world. We have technology and we have low emissions, so on.
So you weren't satisfied, though?
No.
Why?
Because we aren't.
In what way? What are the effects that you feel climate change has in other parts of the world? And what has it meant for you to be here, meeting other people and young people from especially the developing world and from island nations that might be submerged?
I mean, Swedes are living like if we had 4.2 planet Earths, that we steal very much resources from future generations and poorer parts of the world. And I mean, it's us, the people in the rich countries, and the rich countries that have created these problems.
So, Greta, as we end this show, what message to the world would you like to share? And what are your plans for the future? What grade are you in now in Sweden?
In ninth grade.
In ninth grade.
My message for the world is that we have now a short period of time where we can act. And if we don't take that chance, we might be screwed. And so we have to take that chance to act now, because it might be too late and we don't want to be screwed.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy. Can you tell?
Go.
Oh no, we came to your report.
I've got to go to another meeting.
Can you tell us what you think about President Trump saying climate change is a hoax? You can answer the question. Are you not speaking to the press here?
I'm sorry. I'm running late for a meeting. Thanks.
Right, but you weren't running late when you were just standing there. So just answer the question, what is the U.S. doing here since President Trump said he's pulling out of the Paris Agreement? Can you talk about President Trump's saying that climate change is a Chinese hoax? Are you not talking to the press while you're here?
Maybe we can set something up later with our press.
Who would I talk to? Can I ask if you agree with President Trump calling climate change a hoax? You're definitely giving me a run for my money here. Can you talk about why the U.S. is here, since President Trump is saying he's pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord? Can you talk about why you are pushing coal? No answer on any issue? Can you talk about why the U.S. would not welcome the UN report saying that catastrophic climate change is imminent and the world has to wean itself off of coal by 2050?
I'll connect you with our press folks if you want to give me a card, and I'll have them reach out.
We could have spoken this whole time. I don't hold out much hope for you to grant an interview. But if you could answer the question about whether you agree with President Trump calling climate change a hoax. Can you explain why the U.S. is even at the climate summit, given that he's pulling out?
I'll reach out.
Can you explain why the U.S. joined with Saudi Arabia and not well in watering down language around the UN report? Wells Griffith begins to climb a set of stairs, then suddenly reverses course, comes back down, and darts past the various country pavilion exhibits. Wells Griffith, can you talk about why the U.S. is pushing coal at this UN climate summit? Can
Can you talk about the U.S. role here at the U.N. Climate Summit? Why the U.S. is present at all? Can you explain why you won't comment on any issue yet you're here?
If I give you a card, I can do it, but you're really good.
What's that?
If you give me a card, I can have her.
If you just answer a few questions.
I won't wait for it. If you give me a card, I can have our folks reach out, and maybe we can do some questions, but you're actually harassing me. But
can you explain why you won't answer any questions on the issue of climate change or why the U.S. is here?
If you would like to set up an interview, we can do that. I just would need your contact information.
A reporter asking you a question, sir, is not harassment.
That's not what's happening.
Why not answer a few simple questions?
I'd set something up if you would give me your contact information.
So you're saying you will do an interview?
I'm saying I'll get with our press folks and we'll...
Well, why don't you give me your card? Why don't you give me your card and we'll set something up?
I asked for yours. I'd be happy to get you in touch with our press folks. But you're following me around now.
Yeah. All right. I just want to get a few answers. It would take a few minutes.
Wells Griffith further accelerates, sprinting up another set of stairs, taking two steps at a time.
Mr. Griffith, can you just explain why the U.S. joined with Saudi Arabia to not welcome, to demand that the word welcome come out of... Oh, thank you. Okay. I thought you wanted to get me contact information. Well, we're standing in front of the United States of America delegation office. We followed Wells Griffith, who is a representative of the Trump administration, formerly a top aide to Rens Priebus, to ask him about the U.S. side program yesterday, where they pushed coal and fossil fuels at the U.N. Climate Summit. And I went up to him and asked him what he thinks of President Trump saying climate change is a hoax. I asked about why the United States is here at the U.N. Climate Summit, given that President Trump... Wait, I have to take my breath. Hi.
My email is this.
Can you say who you are?
Here. Email at...
Let me take the card.
ClimateCom.
You're not going to give me the card? He said someone would give me a card. Sir. You're not going to give me a card? So, a representative of the U.S. government just was about to hand me a card and then decided against handing me a card. Well, Wells Griffith said they would allow us to get a contact, so we'll just wait here and see what's happening. His office just responded, "Sorry, but due to time constraints, Mr. Griffith is not available for this interview," unquote.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
This week on The Real White Housewives of D.C.
We need the wall. We need, more important than anything,
we have a lot of disagreements here, but that's not the point here. We have a disagreement about the wall.
You don't want to shut down the government.
Because you can't get your way.
The last time you shut it down,
you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No, no, no.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, I will shut down the government.
Okay.
And I am proud, and I'll tell you what.
It was very violent, very vicious, and terrible.
Only on C-SPAN Bravo.
The news today, oh boy, because Robert Mueller is getting closer and closer to his prey.
This week, Americans were hit with the stunning revelation that their president may have possibly lied to them.
President Trump freaked out about the Russia investigation.
The Mueller investigation is closing in.
It feels like the Mueller investigation is finally starting to wrap up.
The special counsel in the Russia investigation revealed that President Trump's ex-national security advisor has been cooperating with multiple investigations after lying to the FBI.
The Mueller investigation continues to grind slowly forward like the world's last glacier.
Robert Mueller's in there!
Bueller? 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 Bueller?
Don't be scared. It's just me, Robert Mueller.
You know the Trump Tower Moscow? You know that thing?
Yeah.
Or as Donald Trump describes it, tower, what tower? There's no tower. Oh, that tower? Yeah, like I've always said, tower. Well, apparently, to get the deal done during the presidential campaign, the Trump Organization planned to give Vladimir Putin a $50 million penthouse. But it's only fair. After all, Putin gave Trump a White House.
Oh, I get it. I am a very good developer, happily living my life.
Okay, that's already three lies right there. What's that? Here we go, Jim.
When I see our country going in the wrong direction, to put it mildly, against all odds, I decide to run for president and continue to run my business very legal and very cool.
I think that's just his way of saying I'm not a crook.
I'm very legal. Very cool. I'm away gone cat daddy-o.
I talked about it on the campaign trail. Dot, 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 dot. Lightly looked at doing a building somewhere in Russia, put up zero money, zero guarantees, and didn't do the project. Witch hunt.
Oh, I didn't know that. He just lightly looked at it. Officer, I didn't kill anybody. I just lightly pushed him off the balcony, which was very high and very cool. It turns out these crimes might not be entirely legal, because we learned all this from the plea deal of former Trump attorney Michael Cohen. See, Cohen was in charge of negotiating the Trump Tower Moscow, along with a Russian fixer and Bert and Ernie's love child, Felix Sater. As part of this deal, the Trump Tower deal, Cohen handed his emails from Sater over to Mueller, including this one from 2015, I will get Putin on this program, and we will get Donald elected. I know how to play it, and we will get this done. Buddy, our boy can become president of the USA, and we can engineer it.
I know how to play it, see? You release the dame's emails, then Buddy, our boy will be sitting in the catbird seat, and those chumps will be none the wiser. His name is Donald Trump. He's got a big fat rump, and he'll win after the email dump. Can do. Can do.
Trump's business isn't the only area of possible collusion. Mueller's also investigating Trump confidant and man screaming, "You'll never catch me, Batman!" Roger Stone. Stone exchanged emails with conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi, instructing Corsi to talk to Julian Assange, and 8 days later, Of course, he sent this email. Word is, friend in embassy plans two more dumps, one shortly after I'm back, second in October, impact planned to be very damning. Here's where it gets damning, because Stone received Corsi's WikiLeaks info, and the next day Stone had one of his private talks with Trump, but insists that the topic of the hacked emails was never broached. Really? What did they talk about in the middle of the night?
Hey, Raj. Raj, it's Donnie. What are you wearing? I hope it's those weird glasses and a suit that makes you look like a Fisher-Price toy of a mayor. Hello? Hello?
It's Christmas time, and President Trump already knows what he wants from Santa. A big, shiny border wall. Although, let's be honest, Santa is not going to give it to him. Because if there's one person who's on the naughty list, it's Trump. Yeah, Santa's like, oh, you've been a naughty boy this year, Donald. You put children in cages.
He's like, oh, yeah, I've been so naughty. I've been a bad boy.
But are you making this sexual? What is wrong with you?
Spank me, Santa. Spank me with the naughty list.
Ho, 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 hold up, hold up.
HuffPost is facing blowback from conservatives after the site reported the classic Christmas cartoon Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer as seriously problematic. Due to what some see as a cartoon featuring bullying and sexism. Defending the cartoon, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "Liberalism is a disease."
We appreciate the help, Donald Trump Jr., but don't you have better things to do, like focus on the Mueller investigation?
Yeah, some people don't believe in Santa, but everyone believes you told your dad about that Trump Tower meeting with the Russian lawyer.
It's true, Santa. His father's a control freak. He had to know.
I bet my pickaxe and gold you're about to be indicted.
If I were you, I'd blame the whole thing on Eric and leave town.
Before your father blames the whole thing on you. I'd move to Moscow. There's no extradition.
It's past your bedtime.
Don, I'm scared. I think there's a boogeyman in my closet.
Eric, there's no boogeyman in your closet. Have you been watching the news again?
Yeah.
You can't watch that stuff, bud. It's too grown up.
They said they're going to indict you.
Oh, don't worry about that, pal. But hey, I am impressed that you know what indict means. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Indict. There's no sugar in Diet Coke.
Almost, but you'll get it. Now, hey, how about a bedtime story?
Okay.
Yeah? Ooh, here we go. 'Twas the night before Christmas. This is a classic. And remember, if there's ever a word that you don't understand, bud, just say stop.
Okay.
Okay. 'Twas
stop.
Okay. 'Twas, that's the words it and was put together, buddy. It's a contraction.
Stop.
Okay. Contraction is a... You know what? Let's just keep reading, okay? 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
Ooh. You hear that, Don? There's something in my closet.
Yeah, bud, that's just the cheap steel Dad uses to build his towers and just groan in the wind. Look, buddy, nothing in the closet. No one's in your closet.
Robert Mueller's in there.
Eric, nobody likes a fibber. Whoop. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, bud. This is my lawyer. I need to take this. But look, Eric, everything's going to be fine, okay? I love you, buddy.
Love you.
All right? Hey, how bad is it? Uh-huh. Oh, God. Uh-huh. But can I flip on him? Okay.
Night, Don.
Hi, Eric.
Whoa!
Don't be scared. Oh. It's just me, Robert Mueller, your dad's friend from work.
I'm not allowed to talk to you.
That's fine, Eric. It was pretty clear early on that you don't know anything.
Nope.
I wish I could say the same for some of your dad's friends.
Like Mr. Pillowfort?
Manafort.
Yeah.
And Mr. Papa John's Pizza?
Papadopoulos.
And Mr. Cohen?
You might want to start calling him Federal Inmate 10358. You get it, Eric?
Nope.
They broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, good man, and it's a disgraceful situation. It's a total witch hunt. I've been saying it for a long time. It's frankly a real disgrace. It's an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for. So when I saw this and when I heard it like you did, I said, that is really now in a whole new level of unfairness.
It's been 8 months since that attack on our nation, the search of Michael Cohen's home and office. And now, here we are. He's going to prison, and we're left wondering what's next for the president. Last night, before Cohen's sentencing, Trump spoke to Reuters about both issues Cohen is right in the middle of, the payoffs to women and dealings with Russia, saying, quote, Michael Cohen is a lawyer. I assume he would know what he's doing. Number one, it wasn't a campaign contribution. If it were, it's only civil. And even if it's only civil, well, there's no violation based on what we did. Wow. Asked about prosecutors' assertions that a number of people who had worked for him met or had business dealings with Russians before and during his 2016 campaign, Trump said, the stuff you're talking about is peanut stuff. Can't even get the expressions right. Trump's remarks about the payoffs are particularly jarring when you put them up against what he and his team have said in the past.
Tell about $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. Then why did Michael Cohen make this?
The agreement with Michael Cohen, as far as I know, is a long-standing agreement that Michael Cohen takes care of situations like this, then gets paid for them sometimes. Gets paid for them sometimes, it's reimbursed in another way. It depends on whether it's business or personal.
It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation. So
they funneled it through the law firm?
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know he did.
Yeah.
The evolution of a lie that make it Donald Trump impeached.
Yeah, look, there are two things about that are striking. One is just how often they lie. They lie at the beginning, they lie in the middle, they lie at the end. And the second thing is how they continually shift the goalposts and have on both of these issues. First, it's that the president didn't know anything about it. Then it's that the president maybe knew something about it, but it wasn't a crime. And then when you get to the fact that it was a crime, they start to minimize the severity of the crime and say, oh, this actually, you know, these crimes aren't important. And you've heard them now talk about all the process crimes that the people around him have committed.
I can't imagine basing any kind of prosecution on the word of Mr. Cohen.
These guys are all new to this at the time. Most of us have made mistakes when it comes to campaign finance issues.
We've over-criminalized campaign finance.
If this is a campaign finance problem, how are members going to look at themselves as the number of their own problems of campaign finance, which is normally a fine? Are they going to leave office?
I've yet to see any evidence coming from Mr. Cohen of collusion.
I don't have any observations to make about that. Yeah.
I don't care. All I can say is he's doing a good job as president.
I think the disturbing thing is that I don't think this works with most of the American public. But you have seen it work with some Republican senators. And if we're thinking about what the ultimate judge and jury in this case would be, it's probably impeachment. It's probably Republican senators. And you saw Republican senators come back this week after the Justice Department accused the president of having directed a crime and saying, you know, Orrin Hatch and others just kind of minimizing it and saying, oh, it's the Democrats out to get him and, oh, I don't care. It is a remarkable thing to see. Long-term senior members of his party debase themselves in the same way that you see Rudy Giuliani do kind of regularly on television.
I want to read you another excerpt from Cohen today in court. He said, recently the president tweeted a statement calling me weak. And he was correct, but for a much different reason than he was implying. It was because time and time again, I felt it was my duty to cover up his dirty deeds rather than to listen to my own inner voice and my moral compass. My weakness can be characterized as blind loyalty to Donald Trump, and I was weak for not having the strength to question and refuse his demands.
The Justice Department effectively called the President of the United States a criminal on Friday as Trump announced the departure of his chief of staff. He's like a feral raccoon trapped in a corner in the attic. If he loses in 2020, they're going to have to chase him out with an Oval Office with a broom. Go! Get on! Get out of here! Oh, no! Now he's biting the broom! On Saturday, for example, he unleashed an unhinged Twitter rant about Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal and unveiled a new nickname for him, calling him the Dick. Wow, he's getting angrier and lazier. The guy's name is Richard, so you nicknamed him the Dick? Go ahead. Take the rest of the week off. You nailed it. Then Trump called his former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson dumb as a rock and lazy as hell after Tillerson, in a rare interview, offered some brutal criticism of his former boss.
How would you describe Donald Trump?
He acts on his instincts. In some respects, that looks like impulsiveness, but it's not his intent to act on impulse. I think he really is trying to act on his instincts. It was challenging for me, coming from the disciplined, highly process-oriented ExxonMobil Corporation, to go to work for a man who is pretty undisciplined, doesn't like to read.
That's the former Secretary of State talking about the President of the United States like he's Mowgli. I mean, he doesn't mean to howl and walk on all fours. He was raised by wolves. Although, in fairness to Trump, the reason he doesn't like to read is that he is bad at it, even if he will never admit it.
Through their lives, and though their lives,
beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year.
They sacrifice every day for the furniture and future of their children.
Instead of saying furniture, excuse me, future, he doubled down on furniture and future. Can you imagine being this guy's Secretary of State? I want to bomb North Dakota. You mean North Korea? I mean North Dakota and North Korea. I meant both. You cut me off before I got to North Korea.
You have the vote. You should pass it.
No, we don't
right
have
now
the vote, Nancy, because in the Senate we need 60 votes.
No, but in the House.
And we don't
you
have.
You could bring it up right now.
Yeah, but
today.
I can't. Excuse me.
The fact is, you do not have the votes in the House.
Nancy, I do. And we need border security. Nancy,
we'll find out.
Nancy.
The Washington Post today gave you a whole lot of Pinocchios because they say you constantly misstate how much the wall is built, how much of the wall is built, and how much is there. But that's not the point here. We have a disagreement about the wall,
Washington Post,
whether it's effective or whatever. Not on borders. That's what we're urging you to do. Not threaten to shut down the government because you let me just finish because you can't get
the
your
last
way.
Time you shut it down. You
yeah,
got
let me say when the president brags that he won North Dakota and Indiana, he's in real trouble.
When
I did.
Let me say this.
We did win North Dakota.
This is the most important.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
good
of shutting down.
That is
and I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we
security
believe you shouldn't
okay
shut it down.
Well, this week, Robert Mueller released the teaser trailer for Trump Endgame. Federal prosecutors said Friday that Michael Cohen committed two election-related crimes at the direction of a person identified as Individual One. Now, we don't know for sure who Individual One is, but let's just say things are getting tense right now over at Individual One Tower. Earlier today, Trump called the Mueller report collusion illusion, which is also my favorite Guns N' Roses album. And yesterday, Trump tweeted with no context or explanation, totally clears the president. Thank you. By the way, I don't blame Trump for thinking his tweets have magical power. I mean, just this week, his tweets about China were able to tank the entire stock market.
It has now been 2 years since the Trump administration first faced questions about its ties to Russians and the firing of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And it's worth remembering just how many times they've changed their story since then. All the way back in January 2017, for example, when the Flynn allegations first emerged, Vice President-elect Mike Pence insisted that the campaign had no contacts with Russians of any kind, period.
Was there any contact in any way between Trump or his associates and the Kremlin or cutouts they had?
I joined this campaign in the summer, and I can tell you that all the contact by the Trump campaign and associates was with the American people.
Did any advisor or anybody in the Trump campaign have any contact with the Russians who were trying to meddle in the election?
Oh, of course not. And I think to suggest that is to give give credence to some of these bizarre rumors that have swirled around the candidacy.
Bizarre rumors around the candidacy? Bizarre rumors were the candidacy. Trump campaigned for president like a high school sophomore gossiping at his locker.
Did you hear Barack was born in Kenya and Ted Cruz's dad killed JFK? Pass it on.
And you know, he doesn't get as much credit for it, but Mike Pence is just as slippery of a liar as anyone else in this administration. The only difference is that when he lies, he crinkles his brow and he uses a solemn tone. And when Trump lies, he sweats like a fugitive is being chased by a pack of police dogs. Just look at the differences in how they lie. Both of these statements were equally untrue, and they were both made around the same time in early 2017.
I joined this campaign in the summer, and I can tell you that all the contact by the Trump campaign and associates was with the American people.
Well, I had nothing to do with it. I have nothing to do with Russia. I told you. I have no deals there.
It's like when the cops separate two suspects in a bank heist, and one of them says, I'd like to speak to my lawyer, and the other guy's in the next room screaming, it was all Mike's idea!
Breaking news this afternoon. President Trump's former personal lawyer and so-called fixer, Michael Cohen, sentenced to 3 years in prison, along with a repayment of $1.4 million owed in taxes and a $50,000 fine. Cohen, who once bragged that he would take a bullet for the president, pleaded guilty to a number of charges, including bank fraud, tax fraud, and lying to Congress. Most notable, however, were charges of campaign finance violations stemming from payments Cohen made to Playboy playmate Karen McDougal and adult film actress Stormy Daniels. Hush money payments with the aim of preventing the public from learning of alleged extramarital affairs. Payments that Cohen says the president directed him, personally directed him to make, potentially implicating the commander-in-chief in a crime. Cohen asked for leniency in his sentencing after partially cooperating with investigators. He hoped for no prison time at all, but the judge refused that request, in part because Cohen denied to fully cooperate. At this point, the extent of what Cohen did and did not tell law enforcement remains unknown, but in a statement released after Cohen's sentencing, his lawyer, Lanny Davis, promised more information is forthcoming, quote, at the appropriate time after Mr. Mueller completes his investigation and issues his final report. I look forward to assisting Michael to state publicly all he knows about Mr. Trump, and that includes any appropriate congressional committee interested in the search for truth and the difference between facts and lies. Mr. Trump's repeated lies cannot contradict stubborn facts. Prosecutors also announced this afternoon that they have reached an agreement with American Media, Inc. That's the publisher of the National Enquirer, which facilitated the payment to McDougal, in which, quote, AMI admitted that it made the $150,000 payment in concert with the candidate's presidential campaign and in order to ensure that the woman did not publicize damaging allegations about the candidate before the 2016 presidential election. AMI further admitted that its principal purpose in making the payment was to suppress the woman's story so as to prevent it from influencing the election.
Here's what Cohen witnessed. The payments to women that we've been talking about all hour, potential business deals with Russia, that was the substance of the final guilty plea from Cohen. And if they, as you've alluded to, if they turn over the rock and look underneath with all the business and all the way that business was done at Trump.org, Michael Cohen's the key to all of that.
Corporation coming for us. This is the Berkeley Signal.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy. Or less 100% of the time.
Are we ready?
Ready.
Uh-huh. Let's go, dude.
Present, but not voting. In a minute.
Before we begin, are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Go
ahead.
Thank you.
KPFA Town Hall Meeting.
Thank you. I appreciate everybody coming out. That's really nice.
Thank you.
Canceling Guns and Butter is going to hurt the station immensely. There are problems going on at the station. I would urge you in governance to help the station and to help get Guns and Butter back on the air. You guys need to turn this around. I'm not in governance. You are. And I hope that you will work with the station to put Guns and Butter back on the air, because this is not good for the station. If you care about KPFA,
got it.
Okay. And then the other thing, Julian Assange. What's going on here?
This is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. I'm Berkeley Kidd. Are there any announcements?
Yeah, I have an announcement. Pacifica Radio is 70 years old this year.
Wow.
Yay, right?
That's cool. I know. Congratulations.
Are there any other announcements?
Yes, I have an announcement.
Smart Alex has the floor.
The DNC emails were leaked, not hacked.
What is your evidence?
Seth Rich was murdered for leaking the DNC emails to Julian Assange.
Really? Why would anyone do that?
The Democrats lost the White House because of it.
Thanks a lot, Seth Rich.
If Seth Rich hadn't leaked Hillary's emails to Julian Assange, Bernie would be president today.
Thanks a lot, Julian Assange.
If Seth Rich was murdered for leaking the DNC emails to LikiLeaks, why is Julian Assange still alive? The mystery guest has his hand up.
Assange is alive because the Russians are unreliable fascists.
The Russians had nothing to do with it.
Why did the Russians rig the California primary?
They didn't. Bernie was robbed by his own party.
Do you think so?
Would Bernie Sanders be president today if the Democrats played fair?
Can you imagine the consequences? First Lady Jane Saunders with that awful hair.
Right. Right. Round one. For 300 points, give a half-true answer to this question. Should face masks be banned in public?
Should what?
Repeat the question.
Should it be illegal to wear a face mask in public?
No, smash all dress codes.
Wrong.
Facial recognition cameras should be banned, not face masks.
You're getting warmer.
Dude, self-censorship is protected free speech.
We have a winner.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah.
I don't get it. How can a face mask be protected free speech?
Isn't it obvious?
No, it isn't.
Wearing a face mask to conceal your identity is self-censorship.
It's my right to self-censor myself in public.
Well, I mean, it's funny, but it lacks wit.
Does everything have to be funny?
Yes, of course. I, I'm a stand-up comedian.
Canadians are not funny.
I said I'm a comedian, not a Canadian.
What's the difference?
Canadians are hilarious in bed.
That's funny, dude.
Canadians are British subjects of the Queen of England, a cold-blooded oligarch with too much money and a fake passport. Okay, the Queen is not British. She's an anti-Semitic German aristocrat with deep links to Prussian fascists. Her husband, Prince Philip, ordered the murder of Princess Diana to protect the royal bloodline and their ill-gotten trillions. I will never bow down to tyrants.
But still, with all that money, I might bow down a little bit.
Do you want to see another Princess Diana sacrificed to Satan?
Now, all royal families should be sacrificed to Satan.
I'm not going to argue with you.
Kings and queens are an oppressed minority. The French beheaded them. The Bolsheviks had the Tsar's family shot. The bastard children, too.
That's harsh.
Well, maybe harsh, but it's better than slavery.
Unless you're the slave master.
Baron has his hand up.
It's not my whole hand.
What does Baron want?
Can I go home?
No, you cannot. It's time to play. Guess the mystery fascist. Guess the identity of the mystery fascist and win a trip to hell. Will everyone please put on your blindfolds? Good. Now, bring in the mystery fascist.
Boo, lock him up, lock him up, boo.
Take a seat.
Where am I?
The first panelist to correctly identify the mystery fascist wins. Each panelist gets one clue. Clue number one.
Are you sleeping with my wicked stepsister?
No.
Are you a man or a woman?
Yes.
Are you homeschooled?
I can't say what I know, and I don't know anything I can say.
Do you belong to Skull and Bones?
Can you be more specific?
Do you know where George W. Bush was on November 22nd, 1963? George H.W. Bush?
He was in Dallas, Texas. We were all in Dallas.
Swing voter has a question.
Does the mystery fascist wear boxers or briefs?
What goes on at Bohemian Grove stays at Bohemian Grove.
Right. Well, what's the difference between a prisoner and a detainee?
There is no difference.
Who's your daddy?
Pussy Riot.
Who pulls the president's strings?
The Pentagon.
Are you a genetically modified transhuman?
Sometimes.
One more question. Do you find me attractive?
I may want you, but I can never have you.
Why not?
I don't drink.
Are you a believer or a disbeliever? I bow down to Jesus, but I worship Satan too.
Satan and Jesus? At the same time?
What about a favorite song? Do you have a favorite song?
Jesus and Muhammad walk into a bar.
That's a great track, dude.
Jesus and Muhammad. Are you walk into a bar? Are you Steve Bannon? Already gone
too far. I'm Steve Bannon's stunt double. Says, what
is this? Smart Alex is in the lead. Everybody else loses.
John
the Baptist shooting pools. The song is cartoon. I say, man, it's just a stupid song. Then they go too far, too fast, too much, too soon.
temper, sips his Shirley Temple, while Mother Mary starts to find her groove. Wrecking ball is playing, so Shiva starts to sway. Now they're making out like some girls do. And the Furies fly around, while the 12 apostles pound. And I scream between my black and my blue. Let me go too far, too fast, too much, too soon.
That was Cartoons by Ira Marlow. I'm Berkeley Kidd.
Caller on line two.
And now, back to our story.
Barron is going to be the first transhuman president someday.
When is that supposed to happen?
After I'm the first woman president.
Why are you here?
I'm here to inspect the broadcast facilities and look at your books. Donald is going to make radio great again.
This network is not for sale.
A bankruptcy judge makes that decision, not you.
I thought bankruptcy was off the table.
For now. But the time to buy is now. Analog radio is hot again, especially non-commercial community radio.
For 500 points, give a half-true answer to this question. What makes non-commercial analog radio so great?
Somebody could be listening.
Wrong.
Amy Goodman is so hot.
Wronger. What makes non-commercial analog radio so great?
Well, analog radio is untrackable. Nobody knows who's listening.
We have a winner.
Yeah, right?
Yeah!
Oh, there you go. Oh. Finally.
After you file for volunteer bankruptcy, I will purchase the transmitters and consolidate programming. There are going to be some programming changes.
Changes.
Barron is going to have his own Sunday morning show.
Is that what Barron really wants?
Whatever.
Barron is too young to know what he wants.
What other changes, Ivanka? Democracy Now! Will be hosted.
Democracy Now! Will be hosted by Steve Bannon.
Or his stunt double.
You people are messed up. Can you be more specific?
My family doesn't understand me.
That's perfectly normal, dear.
Do you believe in a supreme being?
I like Ani DeFranco.
But do you worship her? I do.
I worship the She-King of Heaven and Hell.
Oh, I've not been to that bar.
The subscribers will block you, Ivanka.
Oh, the subscribers have been silenced.
How have you silenced the subscribers?
Oh, liberals would rather lose than fight. We infiltrate the board and deny everything.
But we have evidence of your malfeasance.
Deliberately refusing to audit your books for 3 years.
That's negative campaigning.
Pointing to your record is not negative campaigning.
I deny it.
You acted beyond your authority. You held secret meetings. You offered the network to Bill Moyers.
Bill Moyers accepts corporate contributions. We like that.
The listeners are tired of the infighting. Repeat it often, and eventually the opposition will repeat it too.
The listeners are tired of the infighting.
It always works. I'm offering each subscriber $10,000 to approve the deal.
Praise God.
We are talking about a hostile takeover of the community radio.
I'm offering $130 million to purchase this radio network. Los Angeles, Washington, Texas, California, and New York. Take it or leave it.
We'll take it.
No, we'll leave it.
But I need the money.
The subscribers will never see a dime.
Each subscriber can receive a share of the purchase price. $130 million.
Really?
Why not? The subscribers own the assets.
I need to consult with my calculator. $130 million divided by 17,000 subscribers. Uh-oh. Damn it.
What's wrong?
I forgot to renew my subscription.
Can I host my own religious program on Sunday mornings?
Religious programs are the opiates of the people.
Barron can submit a program proposal to the program committee.
There is no program committee.
Exactly.
Can Barron tell us something about his radio program idea?
It's called Jesus, Queen of Heaven. It opens with an animal sacrifice to Satan.
I faint when I see blood.
Nobody will see it. It's radio.
What are you going to sacrifice?
It's just radio play.
He wants to sacrifice the soul of community radio.
And for every new program, an existing program will be canceled.
Roll the clip.
I have been a loyal listener since the KPFA Listener Rebellion of 1999, when an elite group of self-appointed insiders at this station were caught secretly working to break up the Pacifica network. In 1999, we successfully fought to preserve our precious network and produce many new shows. But today, I'm sorry to report, those same double-dealing, backstabbing corporate Democrats who stole the California presidential primary from Bernie Sanders are once again trying to break up this radio network for the benefit of party insiders and were recently caught acting in secret to incorporate a new nonprofit radio station using our exact call letters and mission statement. These same Democratic Party insiders have infiltrated the governance board of this station. Their aim is to capture our FCC broadcast license by forcing bankruptcy on the network, specifically refusing to submit a yearly financial audit. Once again, they are discussing the sale of WBAI for millions of dollars.
Do you ever feel like a crumbling machine? Like you were built to break, but you keep on moving.
Online at kpfa.org. Restore the program committee.
Do you ever feel like
restore audits
without a door? Walls without
resist
window,
the breakup.
Just a ceiling and a floor.
No corporate money.
Support whistleblowers like Julian Assange.
Remember, Seth Rich.
How loud you yell, no one can hear you anymore.
Free Mumia.
Lock up this guy.
Let it out, let it out, let it out.
Count.
counter-counter-counter-intelligence is complex. Layer upon layer upon layer upon lawyer upon lies of lawyers and lawyers' lies.
Layer upon lawyer upon lawyer upon how many billable hours is that?
By collapsing the stations from the inside out through a series of disastrous administrative decisions, it will look like we just couldn't pay our bills. The economy did it, not me. We have no choice but to liquidate the assets.
What are you talking about?
I don't get it.
Of course you don't get it. It's too technical. It requires experts, professional demolition experts. To dismantle a radio network without anyone catching on requires administrators, corrupt non-profit lawyers, a slippery finance committee, a business manager who pretends not to notice there has been no audit for 2 years.
Oh, I can do that. I was a substitute teacher for history.
You're hired.
What qualifies you to run a radio network into the ground?
The FCC regulations are complex.
But the bylaws are clear.
The bylaws are too clear. I want less clarity. If the listeners discover what's about to happen before it happens, it might not happen.
We will fight you.
You can't fight me. You signed the pledge.
Which pledge?
The pledge to shut up while I sell off the assets. Here it is.
The voices of Ed Holmes, Kalina Lobo, and John Kaur. Ivanka has the floor.
After the network changes management, Pacifica will be rebranded. The new format is radical, but not too edgy. Bill Moyer's radical, but in moderation. Trending soon. Rad Mod Radio. Ralph Nader on line 3.
Do you see satire as powerful a force for a democracy today as it was in the United States 120 years ago?
So I'm trying to get news of the riot. Nothing but snooker on, right? And all my friends here are trying to sympathize with me. Oh, Bill, crime is horrible. If it's any consolation, Bill, crime is horrible here, too. Shut up. This is Hobbiton, and I'm Bilbo Hicks, okay? You live in a fairyland. I was reading the papers here. You have crime like, yesterday, some hooligans knocked over a dustbin in Shaftesbury. The hooligans are loose. What if they become ruffians? I would hate to be a dustbin in Shaftesbury tonight. No one knows what it's like to be a dustbin in Shaftesbury with hooligan. It's such a stupid word, you know? Hooligan. Very unthreatening word. I don't even know what a hooligan is. I think I could take 20 or 30 of them. Just picture these real pale guys in penny loafers and no socks. We're the hooligan. Ow, fucker, come here. Nope, have to catch us. You corner me, I might become a scallywag. I'm an Andy-wag. There was something in the paper yesterday. Some hooligans caused a rumpus. Not quite the same as Crip and blood. It's cutting. A little more telling. Blood. Hooligan. Bloods versus the hooligans. Hey, man, what you doing, motherfucker? Come here. Got to catch up. Here, I'll try you now. There. Catch your skinny, pale ass. How's that? Oh, he got me in the rumpus. The blood hit me in the rumpus. There you go. Crip, blood, rumpus.
Krampus? I don't know. You do not have crime like we have, and you should be very grateful. Our crime is like, yesterday, a student beheaded his teacher, named best in class. Holding up the head.
This is the Berkeley Signal.